Chapter 24, Ecuador's President Battles Big Oil. My work in Colombia and Panama gave me many opportunities to stay in touch with and to visit the first country to be my home away from home. Ecuador had suffered under a long line of dictators and right-wing oligarchies manipulated by U.S. political and commercial interests. In a way, the country was the quintessential banana republic, and the corporatocracy had made major inroads there. The serious exploitation of oil in the Ecuadorian Amazon basin began in the late 1960s, and it resulted in a buying spree in which the small club of families who ran Ecuador played into the hands of the international banks. They saddled their country with huge amounts of debt, backed by the promise of oil revenues. Roads and industrial parks, hydroelectric dams, transmission and distribution systems, and other power projects sprang up all over the country. International engineering and construction companies struck it rich once again. One man whose star was rising over this Andean country was the exception to the rule of political corruption and complicity with the corporatocracy. Jaime Roldós was a university professor and attorney in his late 30s, whom I had met on several occasions. He was charismatic and charming. Once, I impetuously offered to fly to Quito and provide free consulting services anytime he asked. I said it partially in jest, but also because I would gladly have done it on my own vacation time. I liked him and, as I was quick to tell him, was always looking for a good excuse to visit his country. He laughed and offered me a similar deal, saying that whenever I needed to negotiate my oil bill, I could call on him. He had established a reputation as a populist and a nationalist, a person who believed strongly in the rights of the poor and in the responsibility of politicians to use a country's natural resources prudently. When he began campaigning for the presidency in 1978, he captured the attention of his countrymen and of citizens in every nation where foreign interests exploited oil, or where people desired independence from the influences of powerful outside forces. Roldós was the rare modern politician who was not afraid to oppose the status quo. He went after the oil companies and the not-so-subtle system that supported them. For instance, he accused the Summer Institute of Linguistics, SIL, an evangelical missionary group from the United States, of sinister collusion with the oil companies. I was familiar with SIL missionaries from my Peace Corps days. The organization had entered Ecuador, as it had so many other countries, under the pretext of studying, recording, and translating indigenous languages. SIL had been working extensively with the Warona tribe in the Amazon basin area during the early years of oil exploration when a disturbing pattern emerged. Whenever seismologists reported to corporate headquarters that a certain region had characteristics indicating a high probability of oil beneath the surface, SIL went in and encouraged the indigenous people to move from that land onto missionary reservations. There they would receive free food, shelter, clothes, medical treatment, and missionary-style education. The condition was that they had to deed their lands to the oil companies. Rumors abounded that SIL missionaries used an assortment of underhanded techniques to persuade the tribes to abandon their homes and move to the missions. A frequently repeated story was that they had donated food heavily laced with laxatives, then offered medicines to cure the diarrhea epidemic. Throughout Warona territory, SIL airdropped false-bottomed food baskets containing tiny radio transmitters, receivers at highly sophisticated communications stations manned by U.S. military personnel at the Army base in Shell, tuned in to these transmitters. Whenever a member of the tribe was bitten by a poisonous snake or became seriously ill, an SIL representative arrived with antivenom or the proper medicines, often in oil company helicopters. During the early days of oil exploration, 5 SIL missionaries were found dead with Warona spears protruding from their bodies. Later, the Waronas claimed they did this to send SIL a message to keep out. The message went unheeded. In fact, it ultimately had the opposite effect. Rachel Saint, the sister of one of the murdered men, toured the United States, appearing on national television in order to raise money and support for SIL and the oil companies, who she claimed were helping the savages become civilized and educated. SIL received funding from the Rockefeller charities. Jaime Roldós claimed that these Rockefeller connections proved that SIL was really a front for stealing indigenous lands and promoting oil exploration. Family scion John D. Rockefeller had founded Standard Oil, which later divested into the majors, including Chevron, Exxon, and Mobil. Roldós struck me as a man who walked the path blazed by Torrijos. Both stood up to the world's strongest superpower. Torrijos wanted to take back the canal, while Roldós's strongly nationalistic position on oil threatened the world's most influential companies. Like Torrijos, Roldós was not a communist, but rather stood for the right of his country to determine its own destiny. And as they had with Torrijos, pundits predicted that big business and Washington would never tolerate Roldós as president, that if elected, he would meet a fate similar to that of Guatemala's Arbenz or Chile's Allende. It seemed to me that the two men together might spearhead a new movement in Latin American politics, and that this movement might form the foundation of changes that could affect every nation on the planet. These men were not Castros or Gaddafis. They were not associated with Russia or China, or, as in Allende's case, with the International Socialist Movement. They were popular, intelligent, charismatic leaders who were pragmatic instead of dogmatic. They were nationalistic, but not anti-American. If corporatocracy was built on three pillars, major corporations, international banks, and colluding governments, Roldós and Torrijos held out the possibility of removing the pillar of government collusion. A major part of the Roldós platform was what came to be known as the hydrocarbons policy. This policy was based on the premise that Ecuador's greatest potential resource was petroleum, and that all future exploitation of that resource should be done in a manner that would bring the greatest benefit to the largest percentage of the population. Roldós was a firm believer in the state's obligation to assist the poor and disenfranchised. He expressed hope that the hydrocarbons policy could in fact be used as a vehicle for bringing about social reform. He had to walk a fine line, however, because he knew that in Ecuador, as in so many other countries, he could not be elected without the support of at least some of the most influential families, and that even if he should manage to win without them, he would never see his programs implemented without their support. I was personally relieved that Carter was in the White House during this critical time. Despite pressures from Texaco and other oil interests, Washington stayed pretty much out of the picture. I knew this would not have been the case under most other administrations, Republican or Democrat. More than any other issue, I believe it was the hydrocarbons policy that convinced Ecuadorians to send Jaime Roldós to the presidential palace in Quito, their first democratically elected president after a long line of dictators. He outlined the basis of this policy in his August 10, 1979 inaugural address. "We must take effective measures to defend the energy resources of the nation. The state must maintain the diversification of its exports and not lose its economic independence. Our decisions will be inspired solely by national interests and in the unrestricted defense of our sovereign rights." Once in office, Roldós had to focus on Texaco, since by that time it had become the main player in the oil game. It was an extremely rocky relationship. The oil giant did not trust the new president and did not want to be part of any policy that would set new precedents. It was very aware that such policies might serve as models in other countries. A speech delivered by a key advisor to Roldós, José Carvajal, summed up the new administration's attitude. "If a partner, Texaco, does not want to take risks, to make investments for exploration, or to exploit the areas of an oil concession, The other partner has the right to make those investments and then to take over as the owner. We believe our relations with foreign companies have to be just. We have to be tough in the struggle. We have to be prepared for all kinds of pressures, but we should not display fear or an inferiority complex in negotiating with those foreigners. On New Year's Day, 1980, I made a resolution. It was the beginning of a new decade. In 28 days, I would turn 35. I resolved that during the next year, I would make a major change in my life, and that in the future, I would try to model myself after modern heroes like Jaime Roldós and Omar Torrijos. In addition, something shocking had happened. From a profitability standpoint, Bruno had been the most successful president in Maine's history. Nonetheless, suddenly and without warning, Mack Hall had fired him.